Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for May 3rd. Up first is Richard Shimoka, writing on how the Liberals are not going to fix Canada's defense spending problem.
This past Monday, Sean Spear and Taylor Jackson published an excellent breakdown of Canadian defense spending as part of the Hub's new Deep Dive series. Its release is timely for a number of reasons. Importantly, it provides critical context for the recent federal budget and defense policy update that preceded it. However, its greater value became immediately apparent on Wednesday following Minister of National Defense Bill Blair's comments at a Canadian Global Affairs Institute conference on NORAD modernization. The most explosive line was his statement that it was difficult to convince his cabinet colleagues to agree to hit NATO's 2% threshold because nobody knows what that means. I wish I could say this is surprising, but it is not. There is a broad ignorance concerning foreign and defense policy, not only among his cabinet colleagues, but also among the Canadian public. There are many reasons why the government should aim to reach the 2% target, including the political cost of failing to provide adequate security, the risks of failing to properly manage military capabilities to meet the threats Canada faces, and the reputational damage incurred with our allies by being so out of step with their interests. Instead, it's more interesting to understand why the contours of this debate align as they do. For a variety of reasons, Canadians' overall defense and foreign policy literacy is low. For one, only very small segments have ever served in the military. Perhaps more problematic is that Canada's defense civil society is extremely weak compared to other countries. There are very few people whose job it is to cover, analyze, critique, or advance thinking on defense issues. Into this vacuum, misinformation, sensationalist and poorly thought out, takes fill in, further confusing the public on really essential issues concerning national security. That is unfortunate, as potentially a majority of Canadians have good instincts and a genuine interest in Canada having a strong international role commensurate with its size. But most simply have no conception of what that means and are easily led astray. It is also fairly evident that there are ideological views about the military and international relations writ large that are simply ignorant of the reality. Our political leadership, frankly, are lightweights among our international peers. The last leader who was held in very high regard for their views on international relations was the recently departed Brian Mulroney. Stephen Harper and Paul Martin at times rose to that level, but it has been a relatively thin record over the past 50 years. More often than not, parochialism, ignorance, and domestic political concerns have guided Canada's political leadership's international instincts. Part of the issue is ideological in nature. It is evident that members of the ruling Liberal Party subscribe to a very naive understanding of international relations and military affairs. Glaringly, they have consistently misunderstood and understated the lengths to which China, Russia, and other authoritarian governments seek to overturn the international order and the risks to Canada, up to and including direct interference in Canadian democracy itself. Similar issues are evident among some members of the Conservative Party. During his final years in office, Harper, based on a broader policy of fiscal austerity, pursued deep budget cuts that severely affected the military's readiness for the next decade. Similarly, the Conservative Party's recent vote against Ukraine aid because of its carbon tax provisions, despite trenchant support for the beleaguered state, illustrates how even minor ideological wins can override major foreign policy priorities. The broad lack of understanding about defense and foreign policy issues feeds into the budget debate. I have long had one thought about the public's view on defense spending. The actual dollar amounts do not matter that much. Instead, the political perception is all that matters. More generally, Canadians have lost their reference points concerning government spending. During COVID, the government spent hundreds of billions of dollars to keep the economy afloat and people safe. Certainly, much of it was necessary, but very large investments and spending programs, which were by no means exclusive to the COVID response, have undermined the public's understanding of what these dollar amounts mean. There is no better example of how the numbers do not matter than what occurred with the CF-18 replacement saga. In 2010, the Department of National Defense, based on a fairly in-depth analysis, sought to sole source 65 F-35s for $8.9 billion CAD. It was clear that it was the lowest cost, most capable option that Canada could acquire. The Liberal Party, during the 2011 and then 2015 elections, railed against the purchase, claiming it was an unaffordable and unnecessary stealth fighter that did not suit Canada's interests. Once in office, their solution was to acquire a significantly more costly, less capable option, an interim capability of 18 Boeing Super Hornets. Instead of spending $9 billion for 65 F-35s, the governing Liberals now proposed spending $6.3 billion for 18 aircraft through a sole-source contract. Did the Canadian public revolt over this looming boondoggle? Not really. The only concerns were raised by experts who understood the disaster the government was planning to inflict on the country's national security. There was absolutely no suggestion from the public that this was unacceptable. The Liberals were able to gesture vaguely at the fighter jets they did eventually purchase, and the public was mollified that at least they were doing something. Even if that something was the more expensive, less effective solution. No opposition party sought to subsequently weaponize this for their own purposes, and the issue failed to achieve liftoff. Which is fine for those parties' domestic political concerns, but ultimately bad for the country in the long run. But returning to our present 2% debate, this context of negligence from our leaders and ignorance from the masses explains why Blair's cabinet colleagues refused to commit to spending to that threshold. Again, it is not about the actual amounts. Rather, it is the political perception of simply spending more, however incrementally and ineffectively, that is being prioritized. That's likely why the DPU effectively commits Canada to reaching the 2% target while at the same time loudly proclaiming that it actually doesn't. It allows the political leadership to have it both ways. To say to its core constituents that it is being fiscally responsible while claiming to allies that they actually will meet Canada's obligations. Allies are unlikely to be swayed. Most of Canada's European and Asian partners have been able to raise their defense and reach or exceed the 2% threshold, despite also having domestic priorities like healthcare, social security, and infrastructure. But they see the deteriorating condition of the international system and, determined to actually do something about it, have raised defense spending as a result. To them, Canada's shtick is getting old. Furthermore, I suspect Blair, like Anita Anand before him, understands what the budget choices mean. They are clear about the dire situation the military is in and almost certainly realize that if the objective is to even just maintain the extremely limited capability the military has now, 2% spending will not be close to sufficient. But again, it is simply domestic political concerns that are driving decision-making here. Unfortunately, there are no easy answers to address this situation. Raising the education level of Canadians on these issues would certainly help, but that involves a level of policy coordination across different levels of government and civil society that is hard to imagine coming to fruition. Ideas about national service potentially might address this issue, but it would be extremely costly, further waste precious defense resources, and be politically untenable. The problem with facing big problems is that it can be hard to know where to begin fixing them. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try anything. If Blair is failing to find the traction he needs within his own government, then it may be up to the next to offer a clean start. The Conservatives should be eager to champion this cause, if only because it offers another stark area of differentiation between them and the Liberals that they can lean into. Yes, this would be another domestic audience play, but at least it's one with the added advantage of beginning the country's slow climb out of this mess. There are worse legacies Pierre Poilievre could leave than being the Prime Minister who arrested Canada's decline into military and international irrelevance. My advice. The 2% spending threshold is a helpful target, but ultimately irrelevant if the broader system itself is not fixed. At this point, far more important is what we spend on and how than necessarily how much. We need to get that right before the rest can follow.
That was a commentary by Richard Shimoka. He is a Hub contributing writer and a senior fellow at the MacDonald Laurier Institute who writes on defense policy. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Ignacio Cofone, writing on how our online world is the new Wild West and just as lawless. The following is an excerpt from The Privacy Fallacy, harm and power in the information economy.
All your interactions, movements, and decisions are collected in real time and attached to profiles used by advertisers to compete for your attention. Not because they think you're special or because they're interested in learning about you for the sake of getting to know you, but because, regardless of your age, gender, or country of origin, you're monetizable. When combined, these little pieces of ourselves fuel a trillion-dollar industry that threatens livelihoods, lives, and democratic institutions. The worst part is not that we get little in exchange. It's that, much like companies that pollute the atmosphere or that offshore production to places where they can violate workers' human rights, every step of the data industry creates losses and harms that are opaque but real. Companies that collect, process, and sell our personal information create harms that are out of sight but have dire consequences for those affected. Clara Sorrenti experienced firsthand the consequences of data harms. She received death threats, had her home address found and shared, saw intimate documents about her family revealed, and was swatted. Swatting is the practice of falsely reporting a police emergency to send armed units to an innocent person's home, an experience that, for Clara, ended up with an assault rifle pointed at her head. Clara was a victim of Kiwi Farms, a platform that coordinates the gathering of information available online to target trans people. For the law to consider that you harassed someone, you need to contact them several times. So, if a platform pools information and coordinates people who each contact a victim once, as was the case for Clara, it produces harassment while avoiding its legal definition. Describing her experience, Clara explained, "When you get your own thread on Kiwi Farms, it means there are enough people who are interested in engaging in a long-term harassment campaign against you." She left her home after the swatting incident, but Kiwi Farms found her by comparing hotel bedsheet patterns from a picture she took with information available online. Clara fled the country to escape abuse and Kiwi Farms found her again. Viewing Clara's harassment as the work of a few bad individuals ignores a broader systemic problem. In our digital ecosystem, it's easy to obtain and use our data in ways that inflict harm on us, like a roommate exploiting a teenager's sexuality for entertainment or a website exploiting trans women's physical safety for dollars. Because Clara's harms weren't just a result of individual trolls, but rather emblematic of an ecosystem that enables and magnifies data harms, her situation is not exceptional. Part of what's shocking about her stories is that she faced enormous harm from something as common as webcams and blogs. Data harms differ. Some are visible and affect people such as Clara on an individualized basis, with immediate consequences on their livelihood. Daily victims include women facing online harassment and abuse, racialized individuals experiencing magnified systemic discrimination, and anyone going through identity theft because their financial information was taken without their knowledge. Most harms in the information economy, however, are opaque and widely dispersed. Examples are online manipulation to make personal and financial choices against our best interests, called dark patterns, and the normalization of surveillance to constantly extract personal data, called data mining. Clara and other victims are pulled into the information economy, the trillion-dollar industry fueled by the collection, processing, and sharing of personal information to produce digital products and services. When we look at data interactions, we sometimes forget that it's there. For example, in the non-consensual distribution of intimate images, there's a tendency to concentrate all blame on the first perpetrator. But when intimate photos go viral, that means hundreds of people reposted them, and websites derived ad or subscription profit from them. Victims are harmed because there's a data ecosystem that facilitates and encourages it. The information economy enables corporations and individuals to instrumentalize others for their own gain, and it amplifies them. So cases of one perpetrator and one victim barely exist. We lack accountability over what happens with our data and what harms happen to us because of our data. By having a better picture of that data ecosystem, laws can better reduce and repair data harms.
That was a commentary by Ignacio Cofone. He is an associate professor and Canada Research Chair in Artificial Intelligence Law and Data Governance at McGill University Faculty of Law. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.